This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. Here's a story that's 100% true. And it's about how accounting is a great choice of career. Here's the facts.
With accounting, you'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. It's a lifestyle that's less math and spreadsheets, and more traveling, personal and professional growth, and making a positive impact on your family and community.
Want to start an exciting new chapter? Accounting Plus provides free resources that will help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom.
Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com.
Good evening, gentle listener, and welcome to Distractable. This episode, it's big brain time, as beloved Bob goes deep and hard concerning skill sets, socialization, and school. Matchless Mark deconstructs the damage of online onslaught and defends a firm frame. And Wagoneer Wade worries about access to the internet, bovine Blackwater, and shows he studied Socrates. From hentai tattoos to catastrophic overconfidence. Yes! It's time for You're Dumb, We're Smart, Here's Why. Now sit back and prepare to be distracted and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Distractable. I'm your host and I'm so excited about it because I won the last episode because I'm the smartest and the funniest and the prettiest. And I have the juiciest lips. That last one may or may not be true, but...
No, my lips have been kind of chapped. It's real dry here.
Yeah, mine are very chapped, too.
Mine are, like, crispy dry. But we'll get to the bottom of that and many other things, I'm sure, during today's episode, where I will be joined by my two contestants and losers of the previous episode, Mark and Wade.
I didn't lose. I hosted.
Okay, Mark is definitely the loser of the previous episode.
Yeah, I would understand that, but I'm defending Wade here.
Wade is just sort of in that category with you. He's in the same category as Mark, which means he is a contestant, and which de facto means he's also a loser.
Or got caught on my knee mid celebration.
See, loser activity right there.
This is a little antagonistic. I feel like this is just
come on, buds, come on, friends.
You know,
no, it's a friendly show. If you've never seen it before, I'm the host. I pick the winner. I give out points, which I don't keep track of, and then I arbitrarily pick a winner. It's probably gonna be Mark.
Mark.
It's hard to whisper an M. Mark.
Allow you to show my tent of fairness.
You know, can I just say, everyone in the subreddit seems to think that we are bent against Wade. And can I just say, if you look at the outcomes, Wade is very even. He favors me very slightly. I am very even. I favor Mark very slightly, but by like a couple wins. Mark favors me just unbelievably aggressively.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Mark is the one who's against Wade. So
who favors me again? Which one of you?
Anyway, it's Mark's fault, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. What?
So direct all of your mail to markiplier@mail.realworld, and that'll find its way to his mailbox.
Like the MTV show from like the 2000s?
Listen, I was trying to come up with a fake address, and I realized I don't know what format addresses even come in anymore, because I don't use that for anything.
Markiplier@markiplier.mark.
But anyway, I have a topic today, but before that, any small talk?
Oh, it's, you know, it's good. I've been so busy with the movie lately. I got a call going after some stuff because I was like, you know, locking the show and getting everything finalized and going over things. And I had another sprint recently and I get on a call with some of the post people and I'm just like, okay, what's the crisis? What's the crisis? And everyone's just like, no, everything's fine. And I look around and I'm like, but okay, here's a contingency if we do this. So I was like, yeah, it's fine. Good contingency. And I'm like... But I'm gonna have these guys go here and we're all gonna circle back. And this day is like, meh, it's all good. And it weirded me out. Like, I'm not gonna lie, I was really weirded out.
I was gonna say, was like pot just legalized wherever they are hanging out? Or like, what's the
Yeah, everything's actually not fine. Mark is 100% right. Everyone just got so high before the call. Mark is internally just like, what's happening? I know there's problems.
I accidentally deleted all the footage. Got to restart.
Yeah, well, I have contingency for that because I got like 3 backups in my own home and then 1 offsite. Like I have
1 in a lockbox at an undisclosed bank, 1 buried in a vault next to some radioactive waste.
1's on a plane that never lands to refuel, so it's always in the air.
It's got AC-130s flying up to refuel at mid-flight, 24 hours a day. day in a randomly generated flight path orbiting. No, it's. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to protect the footage. That's you don't get that. You definitely don't get that back.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
It's funny because making YouTube videos, I've so many times in life I've been like, I mean, I don't even film as much as you guys have, but I filmed enough stuff where it's like, do I need to keep all of this raw footage for all these things that I have edited into videos? And eventually it's like, no, well, there's nothing in there. All the good stuff's in the edit, probably. It's fine. That's inconsequential. That is actually all just bullshit, mostly. But the movie stuff is like, there are a lot of people who made that happen. And they will never all be in the same place again at the same time on the same set. It's irreplaceable.
I still have almost all of my videos, not the unedited versions, but all of my videos backed up on like my hard drives.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how many terabytes it is, but I forget how many terabytes you said the movie was, Mark. It was like 90 or something.
Right now it's pushing 100.
And I think that's more than my career of the last 10 years combined in edited format, which blows my mind in sheer volume.
No, don't get me wrong. It's like, and don't feel embarrassed. It was more than mine too. Instantly, all three of us combined. You do not understand the sheer size of raw video files, like cinema quality raw video files, pumps out video at about a terabyte or a gigabyte a second.
Yikes.
It's beefy. It's 16-bit video. It's just, it's atrocious, the amount of data that's pumping out of that thing.
What we should have done is had a film crew following your experience making the movie, and then you could be working on the reaction movie of making the movie.
That's what people were saying, is like, I should have been recording more, because we have BTS, and people were going to say the documentary about making this movie was going to be more popular than making the movie itself. But I recorded only like two instances of me actually editing it or in this process. Honestly, like in Ethan's documentary, his reenaction, did you guys see it at all?
Listen, man, I didn't watch your mom's documentary.
Well, you didn't watch his mom's documentary?
We did a whole episode on this, and I'm still getting hate for it.
It was really good. You should.
I know you said that the last time too. He did the quiz about the friend quiz, and I was like, I didn't watch it. He's like, oh, come on, man.
Well, I'm a bad friend to Ethan, so we're in the same boat here, Wynn.
It's okay.
On the bad friend boat.
Look, it's fine.
Shout out to Brain Leak. It's his podcast.
He reenacted this thing in the podcast. It was very
I can see it. I did see his tour. Tour was good. That the thing was about. He had to make the tour to do the. I almost got a tattoo. Which I mean, I never ever getting a tattoo, but he had a guy there who was like, you want a tattoo? And I was like, no.
But you hesitated. You paused for a moment. You're like,
Who was there? I think Pat was there and got one. But like, he didn't eat lunch or dinner that day, and he like got woozy while he was getting the tattoo because he was like dehydrated. What are we talking about?
I don't know.
Wade, your small talk.
This is a random little side note. Do you remember? So whenever I went to Ocean City with friends a while back,
the trip that Mandy and I were there for.
I wasn't there. I was there the year before. I wasn't there the year you guys were there.
Okay.
But we got henna tattoos. But I don't know if you remember that word, Bob. A couple of years before, we did an indie PopCon thing where we were doing a charity event, and the loser between Bob and I, we were leading teams. The losing team, the leader, Bob or I, had to get a henna tattoo if we lost. All day, all weekend, I was promoting this event, walking around the convention, meeting fans. Some of them were like, you know, our age, some were younger. I have a visual of talking to a kid who was probably like, I don't know, between 10 and 12. And I was telling him and his parents about the event. And all weekend, I was calling them hentai tattoos instead of henna. And I remember telling this 10 to 12 year old kid in front of his parents that between Bob and I, the loser has to get a hentai tattoo. And like his parents looked a little like, I was like, I know, right? That's crazy. Thinking it meant henna.
The mom was like, oh, weird. What is that? And the dad was like, yeah, what is that? What is that? What is that? I don't know what that is either.
So I remember that, and the embarrassment that came back once I found out what I had done, because I legitimately didn't know there was a difference between those two words. It still haunts me. It's one of those things that still haunts me to this day. Like, I get the cringy, like, ugh, I gotta like shake off when I think about it, because I remember them looking at me and my reaction of like, I know!
I'm more surprised that both of them knew instantly what that was.
Well, I mean, they were parents of a 12-year-old. They were probably like, what, 35?
You know what? I am curious about that. We have a wide range of listener demographics here. Go to the subreddit and Well, maybe this is a bad thing to encourage. Don't look it up without looking, without cheating. Just say yes or no if you know what that is without looking, and don't look what that is. Do you know the difference between hentai and henna, or even just what hentai is? And if you don't know, that's good for you. You're better off for that, probably.
Yeah, but you're just like corrupting the you.
Bleep it out. Bleep it out, editors. They were going to look anyway. They were going to look.
What Bob's trying to say is Google hentai, especially at work.
Yeah, no, do it on a work computer. Do it on a government computer. Anywhere where you know someone's watching.
That's how you get the good stuff, right? I was just saying to Amy last night, it's crazy that we as people can cast the spell formative memory at any point, just instantly. Formative memory! And this is, it's a very irresponsible spell to cast. And this is irresponsible of you, Bob.
That's okay, because I won't remember it for reasons we're about to discuss. Ah. This is not the topic of the episode. I kind of wanted to make it a whole topic, but this is kind of just small talk, really. But I want to talk about it, because I think it's interesting, and I'm curious. We have talked about aphantasia before, which if anyone watching, listening, doesn't know or hasn't seen that, aphantasia is the phenomenon or condition, I guess, where a person like myself, I am a fantastic. I can't envision things in my mind. When I'm imagining stuff, I don't see like a visual image. And there's a whole spectrum between pure blackness all the way to completely vivid, realistic imagery that people are capable of envisioning in their mind's eye. And we've talked about that I'm basically just, when I close my eyes to imagine stuff, it's like pitch black. I got nothing except maybe a little like twinkly. It's basically nothing. But a thing that is becoming more widely researched and rather tightly associated with aphantasia is a condition, I guess, or I don't know, a state of being called severely deficient autobiographical memory, or SDAM. And this is basically because one of the working theories is people who have aphantasia, because I don't have a very visual memory, it affects my autobiographical memory in a way where I struggle to recall my own life events in particular detail. I've been getting, honestly, I've been going on Reddit and websites and places that talking about aphantasia with other people who have it and people who are researching it and stuff. And it's like a growing topic. And this is something that I think is interesting. When you guys imagine your own lives, your autobiographical memory, do you feel like you're time traveling back? Are you watching a video? Are you reliving it from the first person perspective? Because I'll say when I imagine my own life, it's almost 100% emotional. The things that I do remember very vividly, like I would say I remember James is being born. I remember the like 48 hours around that. I remember my wedding day and the stuff around that pretty vividly. The memories that I have are almost completely emotional. I don't see the thing. I don't imagine visual things, but I don't see visual memories either. So it's like I remember how the hospital smelled. I remember what we ate. Mark, you were in my wedding party before the wedding, and we were like putting our tuxes on and that sort of stuff. Like, I remember what happened, but it's emotional. It's how I felt, how something smelled, how whatever, like that sort of thing. How are your personal memories? I'm just super curious.
Well, here's an example of it, because I was just trying to think about it. As soon as you said I was in your wedding party, I suddenly got like, boom, like a flash of the church. The schoolhouse, old schoolhouse, converted schoolhouse where the reception was.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like a one-room schoolhouse.
Yeah, and I think I remember the church. I think that was...
It's a pretty distinct church as well. It's like very...
Yeah, because it had like the triangular alcove and double level above it. And then for some reason, though, I think my memory works in terms of like, I'll get a flash of some image from there, and then my brain starts to fill in details. Because now I'm imagining, for some reason, I think there were candles the size of like marble pillars, like on the sides. And I'm like, I don't think there were candles that big.
That's not that far off.
There might have been large candles there, but that's where
there were large candles.
Yeah, my imagination fills it in and exaggerates it. So it's like I will grab onto certain identifying details, and then my imagination like scales something up when there was an inconsistent. Like if it was, I never paid attention to something in my memory, then my imagination is like, I know it qualifies it with certain like details. Like it was big and a candle, therefore it's like suddenly it could be pillar sized. So it's there's some exaggerated inaccuracies to my recollection.
Do you feel like you're watching that as like a camera on the wall? Do you feel like you're seeing through your eyes? How does it feel in terms of experiencing it?
It's kind of that thing where it's like when you said I was in your wedding party, it went that first person, like I remember seeing that, and then it kind of floats around it as I analyze certain things and try to recall certain details, because I don't have perfect photographic memory. I can't replay the video where it was, but I do get grabs and instances of imagery that I remember, and then I'll start to float around the space as I try to recall what was there, and I'll try to build the dimensions of the space that I was in and try to recall that. And then that's where things get really loose because I don't have any concrete definitions of the room, so that's where things scaling-wise can get kind of freaky.
It's like, for me, like a clips highlight video combo. It's like I'll have, like, if I think to my wedding day, I can hear, see, smell, like visualize, see the sky. I have like a clip. It's like watching a clip of a moment. Like whenever I first saw Molly in her dress and we were getting photos, I remember turning around, seeing her, the emotion, like everything else.
Turning around.
Like, yeah, I turned around. There she was. But like I can play that clip, but then like the video ends and it jumps to a different moment, and then like that little clip ends and it jumps to a different moment, and then like Mark said afterward, it's like I kind of start piecing together the whole venue by taking like a whole bunch of like those, I don't want to say taking those clips, but like after I relive some of them, it's like, oh yeah, okay, now I can picture the lodge we got married at, I can see different things, I can whatever. The one thing that's weird to me though is there's one moment from our wedding that's not like that significant. We were leaving. It was after everything was over with. We were like packing up some of the stuff we had and leaving because we had to be out of there by a certain time. And I remember like grabbing, I think it was the wagon that our flower girl was in. But I don't see that from my first person perspective. I see it from a third person perspective where I see like my silhouette grabbing the wagon and like the people around me in that moment, which is weird. But that's how my brain puts that back in my head, is like, oh, there's a zoomed out, like I'm on the second story of this building looking down at Wade picking up a wagon. Why is that how I see that? I don't know. But there's always these little snippets of video with sound and smell and everything else attributed to them where I can relive it to some extent.
Interesting.
But they're still mostly emotional moments with some exceptions. I mean, that wasn't that long ago, but if I go back 15 years, it's the emotional moments that I have those memories of that are vivid.
I wouldn't say, I say like there's a separate category for the emotional stuff, but really it's not terribly emphasized in the memories that I have. Like I remember being very moved by both of your weddings, but if I recall them, I don't really recall the emotions of the moment. And I recall like the physical characteristics of it, and like in kind of slideshow snapshot of different key moments. And then I would have to, again, fill in the details. So like I'm bawling. I'm just like two garden hoses of tears just out of my eyes. But the feeling of it isn't really there.
Yeah, no, this, I would say to anyone out there who finds any of this at all interesting, or if you think you might have aphantasia or whatever, it's a fascinating thing. Even if you have a perfectly vivid memory, I think it's a fascinating thing to hear about how different people perceive the world and experience stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was not clear up front. I sort of implied that I have ASTM, and I don't think I do. Just the way that my mind works, I think I have a reasonably good autobiographical memory, but I do think I lose things because I don't have as much detail in my imagination. Mm-hmm. But like people who have severely deficient autobiographical memory say that it feels almost like they're telling stories about other people when they tell the stories of their own past, that they're fully aware that these things happened, but they have no memory or like perception of themselves as even being part of it. And so it's like I'm not saying at all that I fall into that category.
I was gonna say, with the way that you described like the bathhouse story and some of the other stories you've told, like you're the best storyteller I know. I think it would be mind-boggling if you didn't remember them and you told it like that.
I think my lack of visual memory allows me a lot of creative liberty in telling those sorts of stories. I think part of the reason my personal stories are so outlandish is because that's probably not 100% accurate recollection of exactly how it was, but what I'm remembering and conveying is how I felt, right? So in the bathhouse, I felt it was funny, it was kind of scary, and in telling the story, I pick out details to, like, convey that, but in the, it probably is, all of my stories are a little more boring and less ridiculous than they are when I tell them in real life.
I choose to believe the opposite. 100% accurate.
I think that the key element here is that there is a distinct separation between memory and imagination. And imagination is kind of the key thing for, I'd say, consciousness and the conscious application of thought conjuring. You know what I mean? Memory is actually a very autonomic system. And it's the recollection of it is tapping into the files, right? So it's like you look back at that time and you try to consciously connect a neuron pathway that goes back to those memories, and you can chase things down. That's why memory is easier when you have associations, even if it's an incredibly complex thing. The more powerful and distinct and weird the association is, this is for like memorizing vocab or memorizing anything, is the stronger the memory. So it's like it can be difficult to remember a single string of numbers. Like I was just playing the remake of Super Mario RPG. There's a thing where as a child I had trouble remembering. It was like a do re mi fa sol la ti do. You know, it was a certain string. But because I know what it is, and it's sol la mi re do re do re, because I made it as salami redo redo re, and I can remember that even though it's more complicated and it has different meanings, but because there's a lot of associations there. So it's like, but imagination, I believe, is memory is a system that you can't really control, but you can control your interface to your memory and the associations you make. So with Bob being able to tell really good stories, is like he taps into the file system, and the file system is there and has the data, and his imagination is the interpretation engine of those things, so he can then conjure it into. That's what I think anyway. I'm not a scientist, but that's what I imagine is the truth.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. No more overpriced phone plans necessary. Big monthly bills, unexpected overages, expensive, and outdated.
Or you could stay outdated. Vintage is in.
My old phone has the perfect patina of Cheetos dust and teenage stank.
Okay, I have a better option. Mint Mobile, for a limited time, they have wireless plans that include unlimited talk, text, and data for just $15 a month. Upgrade your plan today at Mint Mobile. For limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer, go to mintmobile.com/distractible. That's mintmobile.com/distractible. mintmobile.com/distractible.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. Mint Mobile for details.
This episode is brought to you by Accounting Plus. Here's a story that's 100% true, and it's about how accounting is a great choice of career. Here's the facts.
With accounting, you'll have flexibility, great pay, and the kind of lifestyle you've always dreamed of. It's a lifestyle that's less math and spreadsheets, and more traveling, personal and professional growth, and making a positive impact on your family and community.
Want to start an exciting new chapter? Accounting Plus provides free resources that will help guide you to a successful career in accounting and personal freedom.
Do more. Live more. Visit joinaccountingplus.com.
This is a fun topic. Maybe I'll try and come up with an episode where that can be the whole discussion. But I feel like...
Oh, that wasn't the whole discussion?
I had to stop myself too, because even talking about what everything Mark just said, I was like, consciousness. What is consciousness? We could have a whole philosophical debate about consciousness.
Ah, boo!
Oh, the people love the philosophy. They're here for the philosophy, Wade.
Some do.
No, that wasn't sarcastic. Oh. Mark and I mock you relentlessly for it, but like the listeners are almost always like, oh, wait, so philosophical.
They're fun discussions. There is nothing that unlocks parts of your brain more than questioning things you just take as a definition and as a fact. When you start breaking down words and meanings into like what they could possibly mean and the fact that nothing's definite, it just makes, I don't know, it feels like it opens up my mind.
In all honesty, I do think that is a big thing. And that's kind of, I touched on it a little bit in a previous episode when I was talking about, like, you know, Gen Z just slapping millennials and then turning around slapping Gen Alpha with the raising kids wrong. And there's obviously a bigger complex discussion to say about that. But I thought about it in terms of like iPads, right? Or stuff like that, or entertainment. And it's not necessarily that it's going to completely destroy brains and developments, but it has an impact, right? Because there is a little less imaginative practice occurring at a developmental time if it's purely entertainment. It's not going to like make someone just completely deficient as a human being, but there is something to be said about boredom as a child and the cultivation of I need to figure out a way to entertain myself in a safe way that answers questions and creates puzzles and creates like the solution engine, you know. But I'm not a scientist. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not a behavioral scientist. I don't know the answers to that, but I could see a correlation there of you're good at what you practice. And you can practice bad habits, you can practice good habits, and there's probably some other results from being so immersed in technology that we don't know what the end result is, good or bad. We can probably see some immediate results, but it's like a lot of things in human behavior, we don't even fully understand our own brains, so we're not really going to fully understand the impacts that these things have until it's already happened. Because retroactively studying things versus like consciously watching things is going to be a completely different type of result. You know, it's complex, and that's what I'm saying. It's complex, and I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's interesting to
no. But you could theorize. I have a lot of theories about that. But wait, but this is Bob's time. Bob,
we can keep talking about this. I don't want to shut down a productive conversation. I do think it's very interesting. To what you're saying, Mark, I think it's interesting. I guess the perspective I have on it, and like you said, not an expert, so this doesn't mean anything. We're just three guys shitting around, but there's a lot in the older generations now. There were a lot of people who bemoaned like Gen X and our generation, like, oh, they don't even know how to change a flat tire. They if you put them in the middle of the woods with nothing but a knife, they don't know how to survive. They couldn't start a fire without lighter fluid and a match. And it's like, those are objectively accurate gripes.
Yep.
But also are a product of the fact that we live in a world where that's just not a skill set that's as valuable as it used to be. It used to be if you were on a road trip, you were driving, you know, from wherever you were to go camping or something, and your car broke down and wherever the hell in the middle of Ohio, or you were probably kind of a ways from people. You didn't have a cell phone. You needed to be able to change that tire or put the alternator belt back on or whatever. Like, you needed that skill because that's where the world that you lived in. We live in a world where I've never broken my car. I've had shitty cars that broke down repeatedly, and I've gotten plenty of flat tires. I've never been more than 10 minutes from like a gas station when I've broken down. And it's 100% possible to be out in the middle of nowhere and need those skills. My life has not put me in that situation. And there are a lot of people like me where like, I'm not like a city person. It's not like I live downtown New York or something. There just is more civilization in more places. And I have a cell phone. If I did break down somewhere where I couldn't immediately find help if I needed it, I could call someone, like, no question. I could charge my phone off my car battery. I could borrow my Mandy's phone. Like, there's just so many resources. And I feel like that's where we are with the next generation. Gen Z and Gen Alpha and all the like kids who are coming after our millennial generation are going to live in a world where we're like, you know, they don't even know how social media works. And it's like, well, that in 10 years, maybe that's not the core of their, you know, social life. Yes, there are some serious issues around kids and social media and self-esteem and mental health issues. But like the world that we grew up in is not the world they're growing up in. And I'm curious what that difference is going to be. What are those skills in the new world where, you know, a Gen Alpha kid might not be able to like pay their own bills, except, you know, if it's in an app on their phone or whatever. And like, I know how to write a check and mail it. I did that. But they're not they're going to be able to do shit I can't even imagine, probably. And I'm curious what that is.
I wonder about how, like, starting off with a lot of, like, because a lot of kids do have access to, like, their parents' phones. Like, almost every kid I see at some point has their parents' phone, is either watching a video or can quickly, like, at 4 or 5 years old, navigate to, like, their favorite, like, you know, game they play on the phone, stuff like that. I wonder if they're seeing and consuming content that way. Like, whenever we were growing up, we didn't have access to that kind of thing. So it was like we had TV shows, we had early game consoles like Game Boys and Segas and stuff like that. But, like, there wasn't a YouTube comment section, there wasn't Twitter, there wasn't all this stuff. I wonder if a lot of their early social interaction is through online means and seeing like the way people talk online or like the shorthand typing of words, like how you think this gonna go, and they see stuff like that versus going outside and, you know, playing with people out there and like that being their mainly their only source of social interaction with other people their age. I wonder how that impacts things. If it does at all, maybe it doesn't, but in our brains, I think it does, right? We think if you're living on comment sections, the way people treat each other online when they have that social anonymity versus like in person where you have to be like a little bit more like, you can't just walk up to somebody in person and say, I think you're a bitch, or you're going to get decked in the face. Whereas online, you can say virtually whatever you want without much consequence. So I do wonder how that changes things.
I guess I see that kind of as the inverse of how a lot of people, I would say what you're talking about is how a lot of people talk about how technology is damaging.
Oh, I don't know if it is.
Right. But people like to talk about that, like that is an issue. And I think it is an issue. But like, I think that kids growing up on the internet and having a firsthand experience with that is potentially what needs to change for the next generation of social media to be less the way it is right now. I would say it seems like a lot of the vitriol and terrible shit that's online on social media comes from older people, millennials and up. It's how we behave online. And it's, so that dominates how social media works. I don't know if the younger kids are going to let that keep happening. I think younger generations are not going to be interested in the anonymity of the internet as much as they're going to be interested in how it's useful to them. How can they make it a thing that is like where they do hang out with their friends and it's positive? I don't know that that's going to happen, but I guess I just feel like it's, they are growing up with it as whereas we adopted it as, you know, after we were already sort of developed or partially developed. I'm curious if that will change the nature of that type of online interaction.
Yeah, I think it's just generally a combination of those two ideas. There's always going to be people that are like, you need to go outside, because in every generation, the thing that I want to emphasize is that every generation is not the same like-minded individual that thinks exactly the same. Millennials have a vast difference of opinion across the entire generation. The same with boomers. There are tons of people of different mindsets. So even like there are people in newer generations that also are very much like, I don't care about social media, technology, stuff like that, and work actively. I think the difference is it's harder to ignore. Therefore, a smaller percentage will be more, you could call it chronically online. That's the only term that comes up, because online is the only way of life. And when you grow up with that, it does become the only option because you haven't seen any other potential. So the lack of exposure to the potential for alternatives is what creates kind of more like-minded thinking, not that it's entirely there. And I think what's generally going to happen is there's going to be this trend, especially with the way that social media works now in terms of its polarization and extreme opinion. You must adhere to one mindset or you get shouted at by the entire world. It is a very dangerous minefield in terms of social hierarchy, in the same way as like, yeah, you can't go up to someone and say like, I hate you and, you know, fuck you and your mother, and, you know, you could get punched in the face. But there's also like the extreme social isolation of being hated by 1,000 people online at any moment for an opinion that you didn't think through of how other people are going to think about. That is just as damaging as a punch to the face. And if in all honesty, some people would prefer to take a punch in the face than suddenly be hated by thousands of people. I don't know where I'm concluding with this. It's more just like I always try to consider the perspective of how this is being taken in by other people, because I don't know if there is like this gap in terms of technology between generations, but I feel like millennials and on kind of have the same baseline, because I grew up with the internet, but I was like early into it because my dad was early into it and computers, and when the internet came along, like I remember the dial-up sound since I was 5 years old, but it was different. It's a different internet than it is today, because the access to it and the things online were different, and it was harder to access. So you had to have a little more problem solving to get into it. But at the end of the day, you know, it wasn't even socially based. So it is, technology is there. It is still vastly different.
How old were we when, like, was MySpace the first one? I guess we had the AOL Instant Messenger. Might have been like our first like online social media. It's not really media, but it is. That was around when we were in like junior high school.
Yeah, I would say middle school
onward
ish. So like around 2000 to 2003 sort of time was when that really blossomed.
So we definitely still had that whenever we were growing up too. It was just a little bit less in our faces because we had to turn off the phones, go online, and then interact. It's not like we could just get our phone out and be on Twitter, but we still had it. Okay.
Well, and we're severely unqualified to talk about this, but I guess this is making me think about schools and educators these days. When I was in school, cell phones were pretty big, and like I was in a wealthy school district, so like there were a lot more kids than maybe the average school that had phones, because they're parents just bought them one for their birthday or whatever. But that was like, you keep that in your locker or you get it confiscated. And yeah. I feel like that's where it was for a long time. When my brother was in school, I think it was basically that same sort of policy. But now it's not ubiquitous, but there are a lot of schools where phones are acknowledged as part of a part of the student body that you can't just get rid of. You can't force them to get rid of. So there's like classrooms where it's like, now is not phone time, but there will be time that is phone time later. If you have one, you can get it out. Or like we're doing an assignment, and if you have a phone, you can Google some information about whatever topic we're learning about today. I'm just curious, is that going to make... I would love to know how that works. And I know we don't know how that works, but like, do you think that's good?
Let's go back to school. Let's pull Adam Sandler and go back to school. We'll start from kindergarten.
No, I don't want to do that. Pass.
Is the question specifically about like phones in...
Well,
you know,
like more technology use. Like when we were in school, we still got the spiel of like, oh, well, you won't always have a calculator with you, will you? Yeah, well, we will, won't we?
Yeah.
Well, they have laptops now, too.
You need to know how to look up stuff in books in case you got to use. I don't even know where I would find a book. Yeah. I can find anything I want on the internet, but I'm not sure where an encyclopedia is right now.
I know where some libraries are.
I mean, I know where a library is, but like, I don't have a library card.
I know where the books are. I know where they keep them. Let's go. Yeah.
But yeah, like, is that just because you can't get kids off their phones, or is that a positive development in the way technology is part of life and like teaching them to use it more responsibly? I don't know.
Can you blame them? It's an amazing miracle rectangle. If you showed it to a Victorian child, they would be on their phones in school too. Like, it's like, you can't fault them for having the miracle device. Just like we now, I stare at this doom rectangle all the time.
Oh yeah, mine's laying in front of me on the thing.
Exactly. It's like, we're not different. Everyone's doing this, from boomers to us. As soon as you get the amazing miracle device, you look at the amazing miracle device because that's what it is.
Yeah.
Like, it's a connection to the entire earth at any time, and the opinion machine, it's in the entertainment hole. It's all of it. So I you can't blame it. You can't blame anyone for looking at this. And just, it's kind of, I was saying this in a stream. Someone a while back was like, what's your opinion on AI music like being made with your voice in it? And I went like, it's about the same as my opinion would be if an asteroid is coming to Earth. It doesn't matter. There's an asteroid. Like, it's, I'm not saying it's the end of the world, but it's like, my opinion has no impact on that asteroid that's flying towards the Earth. It's like, I can't opinion away my thoughts on AI or these, what, they aren't really AI, but eventually there probably will be AI. It's like, I can't opinion my way through that right now. Opinion doesn't really have any play in it when it's happening at a face path faster than I could even act upon it. And so with this is like, opinion matters very little when everyone recognizes that this thing is fucking incredible and awesome, but in the biblical sense of awesome, where it can also be terrifying.
Wayne, hit us with the philosophy of whatever we're talking about quick.
What, moral implications of using technology versus remembering what happened before technology, or learning to integrate with technology?
Maybe, but make it interesting.
Fuck you, first of all.
Anytime a philosophical statement starts with something, something, moral implications, part of my brain is like, oh, it's one of these. Yeah, but wait, I'm curious what you think. From your philosophically inclined perspective, is technology ruining kids? Is adopting it just letting people enjoy the amazing technology square that everyone... Ignoring the obvious socioeconomic issue of not everyone has a cell phone. There's a lot of issues facing people who can't afford them, families who can't afford them. If you just assume that in some point we'll live in a world where you get a phone the moment you're born and it's just free because it's powered by advertising anyway... Talk about that.
Okay, I'm going to start this from a different perspective to answer your question. I have concerns about the access. I know, like, my sister is a teacher, And a lot of her kids have school laptops that the school loans out and the students that's can crazy. Use and use whatever have you. And that's mind blowing to me. We had a computer lab with those old towers that like the entire school shared one lab. If you guys remember, there was like 30 or 40 computers in there and we all had to go to the lab.
We had to like schedule your time in there. Yeah.
And now just kids are expected to have like their rental laptops. I worry about school funding. I worry about teacher pay and what we ask of teachers. I worry about how much kids need to know before they start kindergarten. Like the amount of knowledge a parent is supposed to instill upon their kid before they start school is going to keep going up because schools have to cover more and more and more information in the same amount of time. Because you don't want someone to be in grade school until they're 30, but there's just so much information now that there is to know and learn about, and technology is a whole nother facet of that. So I think Mark's right about the meteor metaphor. It's like, it's coming. It's here. We have to, like, there's no not integrating it. You have to. Kids have to learn how to use technology, how to use technology safely, how to use technology to enhance their lives, the dangers of technology, the sites and links that are bad, how to try to spot those things, how to know whenever you're looking up information that's true versus sources that are people just spewing bullshit, which is another, I talk about this, a lot of fun philosophical topic, truth, lies, and bullshit. They're three very different things, and bullshit's scarier than lies because there's no reference to truth in bullshit. You're just talking. Being able to look online for that kind of stuff, much less just listen to someone talk about it, is so hard. Looking at, like, didn't we do it? Was it here that we were talking about, like, an article that was an AI? Our podcast episode list, a review of our podcast episode list. Someone looks up Distractible and they see that, they read it. How do they know it's not our podcast unless they go in and do a whole lot more research that no one's going to do this day and age unless they're taught to and stuff. So I feel like in schools, it's something that has to be integrated, and it has to be integrated well. My fear isn't necessarily in the application and use of technology. It's in the fact that I don't know that schools and teachers are given the tools to succeed in doing their jobs as they have historically, plus adding the technological component in.
I mean, there's definitely an entire issue surrounding funding and teacher pay and where that is in our country as opposed to a lot of the world. I do think it's interesting the you framed it, I guess, like now there's a lot of info as opposed to in the past there was less. And I don't think that's really the case. I think there's been a lot of human, like, there's been a lot of stuff you don't learn in school since before we were in school. The thing about public education is, and this is more of my opinion than anything else, but, like, the point is not that you're supposed to learn a lot, or you're supposed to learn everything. The point is that as a society, we're supposed to generally select what are the most important skills, and those are what should be focused on in the amount of time you have to get a public education. And I think you're right that those are changing. Media literacy, online literacy, social media usage, and literacy are, like, should definitely be taught in schools.
What do you replace for that, though, that we learned? Like, what do you get rid of?
The way I see it, there's like two types of things that school teaches you. You need to learn like knowledge-based type stuff, like about how the world works. I feel like it'd be really helpful if you learned how to maybe file taxes in school, or like you take a home ec class and you learn, you know, you learn how to cook a couple dishes. You learn how cooking works. You skills like this, right? Like you get some knowledge about something that's useful, practical, maybe not very practical, or that you use in your life or to go to college or whatever. But also the other thing about school is you need to learn how to learn. You need to learn how to think critically, right? It's less important necessarily what you learn. And this is, I think, where, you know, there are still, like, you take calculus in high school. You take, you take classes in science. You take science, like physics classes and stuff, full of knowledge that might be useful, but really practically is not very useful to a normal person in their day-to-day lives when they're an adult. There's not a lot of stuff I learned in math classes in high school because of the career choices I've made and where I am in life. I just, like, I don't use the knowledge, but taking those classes taught me how to analyze complicated math problems. It taught me how to think, and there you need classes where that is also, like, the thing. And so I don't think there's anything that absolutely needs to be, there may be some things if I really thought about it, but, like, has to be curriculum because you have to know how it works necessarily. The education has to match with, like, where society is, where technology is. And I don't think in America, I don't think it does in a lot of places. I think there are a lot of things that our society is currently dealing with, especially online literacy and especially critical thinking. And like you were talking about bullshit versus lies and that sort of stuff, that is not really, you know, you're not equipped with the tools to try and parse that and deal with that in the real world in some of the public education that people are getting. So I don't know how to fix that, but that's like philosophically how I think it should work.
The one problem I have is that another thing school prepares you for is finding a job in the real world.
No, it doesn't.
It gives you an idea. You get a taste, right? It's a sample.
No, it doesn't.
It is a sampler of what different things you can do. So like if I didn't have any math classes and I had no idea that math was a thing or how to do math or whatever, I would never go out of my way to look for it. Some people that go into mathematic jobs, like we've got a friend, our friend Jesse, does math for a living, and he tells me some of the problems he does and how in the world to solve it and shit like that. And it's like, Jesus. So at the very least, getting like a pre-algebra or an algebra, I feel like is important, because it's like, okay, well, if you get to that point in math, maybe you find that you enjoy it and you know you can pursue something in that. If you eliminate a lot of these things to make room, then you're getting a smaller and smaller sampler platter of what's out there. And I'm not saying we all have to have spelling classes till we're in sixth grade, but it gets complicated with what do you remove to make room for more things. But I agree with you, the most important things are definitely developing social skills, developing critical thinking, and so on and so forth, like you were saying. And I wish philosophy was a mandatory class, because I think philosophy did more for opening up my mind than almost anything we did throughout junior high and high school. And I took that in college, and it was like one philosophy class changed my entire outlook on how I approached my future. So it's so complicated to figure out where you change things up, but we do have to adapt, like you're saying. I just don't know how you put that on a teacher to know how to do it.
So there is this kind of mindset of learning to learn, and I agree with it fully. Like, I think people should learn to learn. But the problem is people learn to learn in different ways. And I and many people in my generation are partially responsible for this thought process that school is unimportant. I'm not saying you guys are. I'm saying me specifically, because I've dropped out of college and I have said many times, like, yeah, you don't necessarily need a college education anymore, has maybe perpetuated the idea that education in general is not important. And false confidence is the death of so much ambition, because if you think that you're competent in something but you're not, you wouldn't even know that you weren't. So there's kind of a fine line between learning to learn, self-discovery through philosophy or whatever it is, and the false confidence that you have that, because no one is more confident in their surety of the universe than probably a teenager is. And no one is at more risk of falling into the ego trap of that than a teenager is. And there also is a very common trap of what you were saying, Wade, and I'm not saying this is you, but it's like there's a common joke of philosophy majors in philosophy 101 that want to diagnose everybody and think that they know the universe. Like, that also is a fallacy in and of itself to fall into. And I'm not saying that's what you're saying, and I'm not saying anything about that. It's just such a more complex issue that can come from so many different places, and the what it needs is like years of research and to reorganize the entire system of school in general, because I think that people are recognizing that school as it is today was started because they needed people to fill a very specific role of office worker that was necessary in that time. They needed people to be data and analytic machines, that when computers came around, that fundamental unit of human was not as necessary. And so it did adapt, and human and life skills were always part of it. But in the end, like the mathematical basis, geometric basis, the typing basis, or the writing, handwriting basis more specifically, and the cursive basis was all to emphasize this kind of like data processing worker unit. But a lot of the holdovers that we have are from those days of those fundamental things. And there hasn't been enough research into how to teach kids how to learn to learn. And I think like there is probably an entire upheaval in the educational system that needs to take place, because now when you have tools that allow people to find knowledge so easily, especially and knowledge that could be wrong with ChatGPT, but that'll get better. I know it will. And to think that it won't is also like not good thinking. So we gotta like adapt and adapt quickly, because again, like the meteor, it's coming no matter what. Opinions don't matter, but action does, and like standing around to look at the meteor as it's falling is difficult. I'm not saying I know the answer, but the answer is definitely not one thing.
I want to touch on the point about the philosophers, which again, I know you're not accusing me, but the thing I got up from philosophy is I was the know-it-all teenager that you're talking about. I was a really, really good student. I knew that I was going to be a successful lawyer and a judge if I wanted to be. Like, I knew this, I knew that. And whether we share them or not, we all have our beliefs and thoughts on big-time issues like death penalty, abortion, so on and so forth. And I had my views in my head, and I knew, and I knew what was right, I knew what was wrong, and I knew all this stuff. What philosophy did for me was it showed me that I didn't know anything. And I think it helps you understand why you have some of the opinions and beliefs and thoughts that you do, but it allows you to open your mind to the possibility that you're wrong. That is something that is a crucial skill to learn, especially when you're a teenager, is to understand that even though you think you're right, you believe you're right, and you don't want to hear anything otherwise, learning that you can be wrong about anything and everything, I think, is very important. I think that allows you to communicate better because it allows you to actually listen to somebody else when they talk to you. If you go into a conversation thinking you are right, whether it's in a relationship, a friendship, you know, mom and son, whatever it is, and you just think you're right, you are not going to be open to listening to the other person's point of view. You'll just kind of like, yeah, here's why I'm right. Whereas if you truly understand that you don't have all the information ever, and you hear somebody else giving you their perspective, even if you still disagree in the end, you can still grab useful nuggets of information from what they presented to you. And I think philosophy opening your mind like that is a crucial thing that a lot of people miss out on because everyone is just so, dad said this, therefore that.
I agree partially. I actually do think that there is value in self-confidence and believing that you're right. I'm not saying you're not saying that, but I believe that going into every conversation and argument or debate, thinking that you might be wrong is also not the right answer, because there needs to be some basis, some rock for which you to stand on before you go into anything, or else you are too susceptible to other people's opinions. If you go into everything thinking,
well, there's shades of gray to it, right? Like, you can go in,
yeah, and that's what I'm trying to say.
You can go in 95% sure that you're right, or being like, you know that 95% of what you're saying is accurate, but there's some room of like, oh, okay, that's interesting. That brings another, like, I still think I'm right, but the way you presented that, maybe I'll rethink this aspect of it, or maybe there's just more information to be had. But overall, I'm still like, it doesn't mean you're always wrong about things. It's just, it leaves you open to taking in more ideas and more thoughts, even if you end up not agreeing with them. And you might be right 90% of the time. Sure, you can have that confidence, but there's still that one time that someone brings something to the table that you might not have listened to if you weren't open to listening.
Yeah, and I think that's the most important thing, is like being willing to listen to other people. However, I also say there are some people in the world that are not worthy of listening to. There are some people in the world that you absolutely actively shouldn't listen to because their thoughts are pervasive and dangerous.
But you learn to see those because you can tell how a person is communicating once you've understood that. And you can see whenever someone's referencing a real grounded reality theory, fact, whatever have you, versus someone that is bullshitting, when you have those tools, which is another part of learning that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very complex system because obviously, how do you know if someone's opinions are dangerous? And self-confidence can be overbearing, and you can think that you're right and don't have to listen to because everyone around you is evil. And that also is a balance. There's so many people out there that are like so confident in what they do and so assured of themselves, and that kind of is what social media helps perpetuate, is just these echo chambers of righteousness, and the echo chambers of everyone else who does not think like this is wrong. And that's how the ostracization system in social media, where suddenly thousands of people can disagree with you, that's why you'll see so many tweets and posts that always have a qualifying statement. That's like, if the common thing is like some celebrity did something wrong, or some celebrity is like annoying or wore the wrong shirt, someone will say like, now I don't like them, surely I think we can all agree, but that wasn't so bad. I see that all the time, the qualifying statements of like social acceptance. And so the debate, however, is more difficult because you're not debating with one person, you're debating with the entire world at all times. And you're exchanging information in ways that human nature was never prepared to handle, but also is largely irrelevant because the value placed on those internet-based social interactions are actually not as valuable as they seem in terms of numerical, like, accuracy. 1,000 to 1 seems bad, but on the internet, it's like, it actually isn't, because they don't know you and aren't willing to know you in most circumstances.
This reminds me of a quote. I forget exactly how it goes, so I'm paraphrasing, but it goes something like, there's few things more dangerous than the confident fool, and few things more tragic than the insecure genius.
Well, I think we can agree that all three of us are one of those two things.
Mm-hmm.
The real predicament is that I need to pick a winner out of all of this.
Well, the winner is clearly the person who's right.
Wait, that means it's him.
And you're throwing your opinion in with theirs.
I fully endorse whoever I choose as the winner. But I do feel like I also want to disclaim, we're basically just talking. This is the most cliche podcast shit ever. But this is a discussion, and if you draw any conclusion from this, draw the conclusion that we don't know what we're talking about. These are all very opinion-based things, and they may or may not apply very well to your life. I think the most important part of this discussion, because I'm sure there are people out there, educators out there, philosophers, who are hearing us talk and are just like gouging their own eyes out because they're like, no, no, because they've spent their entire life researching or thinking about this thing. That's very possible that you know better than we do. Talk about it. Talk to people about it. Ask questions.
I'm 95% confident that they're an idiot and I mean, their degree was worthless and they skated through school because their pappy knew someone.
They probably cheated on all their exams.
I think cheating in terms of school is actually a problem solving skill builder.
Okay, well, you know what, Mark, you just solved my problem. Up until that exact moment right there, I was thinking I was gonna make Mark the winner until he literally endorsed cheating to pass school.
I'm not saying that's like...
And I feel like I have to say that Distractable does not endorse cheating. Don't cheat on your test, kids. Learn the material, even if it doesn't feel applicable.
I've learned more material trying to cheat than I ever did doing homework.
That's because you didn't do homework.
I know. Cheating things was my homework.
Because he's such a morally pure and superior being and does not endorse cheating, today's winner is Wade.
Morally superior, I don't know about, but thank you. I'll take the win. I won't question it.
All right. You're not morally superior. You're morally equivalent.
Thank you.
You're greater than or equal to us morally. How about that?
I'll take it.
Mark, I don't know what you're so salty about.
What, you just said you took the winner? Why would you? Well, I don't know why you're so salty.
It's fine, Mark. Just listen to my winner speech in a minute and copy it so you can say it next episode that you win.
All right. Okay. All right. Cool.
Yeah. No, Mark. You know what you should have done? You should have written more of the answers on the back of your hand so you could have.
I should have written. Maybe should have cheated in school more.
I didn't cheat in school, Mark. I just didn't learn. Okay. congratulations to Wade. You have a winner speech, Mr. Philosopher?
I think what Bob was saying about us not knowing everything is very important. However, I do think that starting a conversation is, and this is a conversation starter, and I think it is always healthy whenever you're willing to have educated and, like, calm debates with people. Don't go into a debate being forceful and being, like, belligerent about it. If you truly communicate and listen, even if you end up being right, know you're right, think you're right, whatever, still humor the person, because every now and then you'll find a nugget of information or something that will be helpful, or maybe you'll learn that you are in fact wrong or that you just don't know. Keep an open mind and stay civil. You'll be surprised how far that might get you.
Mark, give the opposite speech for your loser speech.
I think what Bob was saying about us not knowing everything is utter horseshit. I think that when you go into a debate, you should come armed to the teeth with secret knives stashed in your back folds of your mind to pull out and wrench into their medulla oblongata at every moment. Everyone's wrong. You're right. And don't let anyone convince you otherwise. All right, this is actually kind of counter to my entire philosophy, so I'm going to back up a few steps here.
Well, I thought we were about to get to the point where, like, and if they keep disagreeing with you, start insulting them as a person, their appearance, their thoughts, their family. Really rip into them.
No, well, because my actual basis is no one is a bigger critic of me than myself. And that's how it always is going to be. And evaluating my own self-worth has been a lifelong battle. And I think for all of us, it's a battle that some of us don't win. And it's a complicated battle. And so for me, I always want to encourage people to have an open mind about things and be willing to learn, but also be willing to learn more about yourself. There's so many other things in the world to pay attention to, but there's only one you that you will ever have as a constant companion inside your own head. There is a kind of mental toughness that you can build up by having self-assurance. Having ego is not an easy thing. Having self-confidence is a very difficult thing, and it's a discipline that takes a long time to learn and a long time to wrestle with, and it can be your greatest armor in those times of adversity when you are not sure of yourself, by having the mental discipline to build up that strength of self-confidence while still not falling into the trap of full-on ego all the time. It's a tightrope. tomorrow. But life sometimes can be that balance between so many things. It's like, there might not be just black and white, but I promise you the gray area is much smaller than we think it is. It's a very narrow path to walk, like, and have that full sense of healthy balance. And there's no right answer of where that is, but it's, I think it's a series of repeating gray lines with white and black in between, as opposed to just like a big swath of gray. Anyway, that's my actual thoughts.
I think there's a big difference between having confidence, which is a good thing to have, and having bravado or false confidence that you portray to act like you're something that you're not or know something you don't.
Yeah.
I agree. That is the end of the episode. You can find Mark at Markiplier, Wade at LordMinion777, or Minion777. I am MiceGerm. Come for us to educate us in the subreddit, because I'm sure you will.
Come for us!
We're here to have a discussion. We're here to hear you out and then insult you personally when we don't like what you have to say about our opinions. But more importantly, be nice to each other. Be open. Listen. Be willing to have your mind changed. Lots of good points today, boys. Not exactly the episode I thought we were going to have, but I like it. Wade, you're hosting the next one. Congratulations. Mark, you suck. Podcast out.